This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. There was a kind of boom taking place in the 1970s, a small-scale revolution that saw progressive political activists opening businesses to support their politics. History professor and author Joshua Clark Davis dug into the history of these independent enterprises and their owners, and he tells their stories in his book, From Head Shops to Whole Foods, The Rise and Fall of Activist Entrepreneurs. And he joins us now on the program. Welcome, Josh.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good to have you. I should point out right here now that there's no doubt that the Durham Co-op Market will come up in our discussion, and I was a past president, and I'm currently on the board of that market, so when I talk about it, you should know that I have that position. Let's talk about the 1970s, protest movements, hippies, anti-business, business is the anti-everything, and yet you see this proliferation of businesses out of that in the 1970s. What's going on, Josh?
I think what you had in the 1970s was activists who experienced the protests, the marches of the 1960s, and towards the end of that decade, they were looking for a new way to get their ideas out. And one of the ideas they came upon was small businesses, things like feminist stores, like Black Power bookshops, like natural food stores. And the idea was really to use small businesses as a vehicle for spreading ideas and for really promoting democracy and equality and even social justice through small retail.
So part of it is the product. You talked about natural foods, about books and other products that would promote these ideas. And then the other point you make in the book is that it's about space, about getting people together in one place.
Right. So in addition to products, these small businesses wanted to change what kind of place a small business could be. They used the term like free space. I think today we might say safe space, but it was basically supposed to be an area with four walls where activists could come together, where marginalized peoples could come together. I mean, obviously, this is basically right on the heels of legal Jim Crow, and this is an era in which, for example, banks still discriminated in their lending practices against women openly. And so these businesses were places where everyone was welcome, where activists were especially welcome, and also places where someone could wander in and really discover a movement and also find a place where they were welcome. Queer people, also hippies even, who we think of as kind of like harmless burnouts maybe, but in the 60s and 70s they were still seen as dangerous radicals, and a lot of businesses didn't want them coming in into their spaces, so they needed spaces too.
What about the business side of this? I mean, the hope is that you will make at least as much, if not more money at the end of the week than you spent. How important was that? Were there business models to starting up these new businesses?
I think what you had with these businesses is a very different sense of what makes a good enterprise, what makes a good business. And so, yes, they all wanted to stay in business, but they had highly political goals and ideals. And so a lot of them were willing to live with smaller profits or maybe even with no profits, just covering the costs and keeping the lights on. And again, an ultimate goal was to really diffuse political ideas, to maybe have a place where all people could shop and also all kinds of people could work, but also to create really a laboratory for making business more democratic, right? Things like non-hierarchical management or cooperative ownership or just democratic consensus decision-making processes. So a lot of these businesses didn't last for very long, but some of them did, and some of them found a way to keep the lights on, even if they didn't maybe fit into a traditional sense of business success as maybe a MBA would define it or a business professor.
You looked at some North Carolina examples. Let's start with the Uhuru bookstore in Greensboro.
Right. So this was, I believe, founded in 1971, and it had a connection to what was known as the Malcolm X Liberation University. And there's a lot of Black Power activists in Greensboro around that university, which grew out of Duke, was essentially what they called a free university back then. But it was a Black Power bookstore. It was a bookstore where you're supposed to go and to be able to find the writings of Malcolm X or Angela Davis or any number of radical thinkers from that period. And it ended up being a center for organizing, too. And, for example, after the Greensboro Massacre of 1979, where a number of members of the Communist Workers' Party were killed, that bookstore is one of the very few bookstores or few places of any kind in Greensboro that let that group meet again in public. The, you know, the fears of another shooting were so great that they couldn't even rent out meeting halls or meeting spaces.
All right, and let's move to Chapel Hill now. Tell us about Lollipop Power in Chapel Hill.
Okay, so Lollipop Power, and I think actually there may even have been a previous State of Things episode on Lollipop Power, yeah. But it was a group of feminists around UNC who started a women's bookstore, but especially it was a women's and children's bookstore, and it's supposed to be a feminist children's bookstore. And I think this was part of a much larger movement of activists involved in the women's movement who realized there are very few bookstores that are giving much space to women authors, and really the writings of the feminist movement weren't getting into mainstream bookstores. And Chapel Hill had one, it was Lollipop Power, but there was a number of these, not only feminist, but feminist children's bookstores throughout the country.
And not just bookstores, but also the banking industry, Feminist Credit Union, right?
Right. So as I mentioned before, credit discrimination, especially against women, was totally out in the open. And into the early 70s, federal legislation didn't ban it until 1974, I believe. And it was very, very hard for married women, for example, to get credit in their own names. All these different ways in which women's credit ratings were unfairly affected just by the fact that they were women. And so a number of feminists got together and started a credit union in Detroit, where essentially the rule was if you join a group like NOW or another feminist organization, you can get into this credit union and get loans for any reason. And so these feminist credit unions popped up all over the country, and I think there were almost as many as 25 or so by the late 1970s scattered throughout the U.S.
Now, this all sounds like some, you know, pretty harmless activity among a bunch of people who will never really make it to the mainstream, but let them have their fun. And yet it does draw a lot of attention, and it is quite threatening. And we're talking about FBI surveillance, police raids, right? I mean, this was scary to a lot of people in power.
So a lot of these activists were political radicals and were seen by a lot of people in public as dangerous people. So, for example, J. Edgar Hoover in 1968 issued a memo warning all of his agents across the U.S. to watch out for what he called African bookstores that he saw as fomenting dangerous radicalism, and that every agent should keep their eyes open for and take notes on them. And then even things like hippies who started head shops. I mean, a head shop is something you don't hear much about today. People call them smoke shops or vape shops. But back then, they were basically places where you get records, you get blacklight posters, you get paraphernalia for doing drugs, pipes and rolling papers and so what. And essentially, a lot of police just saw these as centers for selling drugs and also for basically fomenting anti-war protests also. So they a lot of those places got shut down or raided or just harassed in all kinds of ways.
So those are the tensions and pressures from the right. But interestingly enough, on the left, also pressures about the business side of this, and particularly as you get into the higher finance. Let's talk about credit unions. I mean, you talk about a debate, this public debate, over whether or not feminism and business should ever be in the same sentence together, not to mention the same building.
A lot of these movements had very active and at times even fierce debates about whether they could tame capitalism enough into advancing their goals. And the women's movement probably had the most extensive and the most thoughtful and the most thorough debate about it. And you had activists all over the country saying, okay, can these bookstores, can these credit unions, can they undo some of the oppression that they saw capitalism as carrying out, or do they just replicate it? And the debate spilled out into feminist newspapers, into magazines, and was a very interesting discussion and debate about whether or not a business enterprise can, in fact, advance goals of justice and equality.
And, of course, some of this centers around the business models, particularly cooperatively owned businesses that are privately owned. It's private enterprise. The government does not own the means of production. That would be communism. This is capitalism, but it says we're going to diffuse the ownership and the decision-making, the governance, among all of our participants. So it democratizes the workplace and leaves capitalism in place. But it was something that seemed to get lost in some of the discussions over kind of how these businesses could move forward.
I think the point you made is really important, that there are a lot of different styles of ownership. And I think in general, consumers are not aware that a cooperative is a different business model with a different form of decision making, with a different form of how profit is distributed. And there are alternatives to a traditional limited liability corporation within the capitalist system. And that was hugely important for these businesses. And a lot of the debates hinged on whether activists thought, well, can a co-op actually do something different than a traditional single or dual proprietorship?
And of course, what makes it doubly difficult to explain is there are so many different ownership models within the co-op structure. You can have a top-down management system that the workers all agree should be right, or they can all participate and vote on every, you know, every time the door opens and closes. And that's the problem if you're trying to convey the importance of this new model that is more democratic and equally capitalistic, and you have so many models to deal with. It's pretty hard to get people to focus on the endless possibilities. Would you say?
Yeah, and I think you're speaking as a real kind of seasoned co-op pro. But yeah, we're talking about consumer cooperatives. We're talking about worker-owned cooperatives. We're talking about ones that are very small and which virtually every member owner attends meetings and attends, you know, management sessions versus much, much bigger ones.
Let's talk about what happened to these businesses, because many of them just sort of ran afoul of not being properly managed, and others got co-opted by much larger organizations that said, hey, this stuff is working, this natural foods thing, there's some money in it, says Jeff Bezos. And so now Amazon owns Whole Foods, et cetera, right?
Yeah, and so Whole Foods Market is a real interesting example, because the owners really came out of the hippie movement and the environmental movement and kind of the anti-war culture of the 1970s, and the original name of Whole Foods was actually Safer Way, right? That was a criticism of Safeway and a criticism of chain supermarkets and all that those things entailed. And Whole Foods Market started out with things like profit sharing, and it started out with all kinds of kind of new age, kind of spiritual ideas. And over the course of the 80s and 90s, it became much more conventional. It went public. It moved away from kind of its progressive roots into a more, in some ways, apolitical kind of space. But also, you know, most of your listeners will know that the founder, John Mackey, is a big libertarian fan who condemned the Affordable Care Act and is, you know, deeply, deeply opposed to labor unions. So that company made a big shift, but really brought natural foods into the kind of the mainstream economy.
Well, this gets to, again, some of the inherent tensions that in order to make these businesses work, many of them had to shift business models. Again, I'll point to the Durham Co-op Market. I'm on the board, but I will talk about how the governance changed from the Intergalactic People's Food Conspiracy to what is now the Durham Co-op Market, both equally intentional in bringing good things to the community. But the governance model changes, and we say, look, let's let the managers manage, and we'll just sit back as a board of directors and not tell you how every head of lettuce should be placed on the, which is what happened in some of the older co-ops. Everybody got involved in decision-making, and a lot of businesses failed.
Right. There was a saying from the 60s, freedom is an endless meeting. And I don't think most people prescribe or subscribe to that idea that 6, 8, 10-hour meetings are really the path to a joyful life. But the idea really was that democracy is something that has to be at the center of any cooperative. And, you know, just even thinking about the name of the original Durham Co-op, the People's Intergalactic Food Conspiracy, I mean, I think that really tells you kind of the cultural moment that came out of versus the Durham Food Co-op. But I think
Durham
what
Co-op
is,
Market, to be clear, but go ahead.
Yeah. excuse me. I think the thread there, though, is that anyone who knows anything about the co-op in Durham now will see that it is very thoughtful, very intentional. And just looking through the annual report, you see things like, well, any low-income household that qualifies for SNAP, for example, qualifies for a less expensive membership. And that membership brings what was once, I think, 10% and now 20% discount on food. And that's a really big deal. You have to ask yourself how many businesses are willing to extend a 20% discount to their low-income shoppers.
But have we gone too far? In other words, in adapting to the current environment? And in trying to make ourselves more viable as a business, have we sacrificed, or in general, as you survey this movement from the 70s to now, do you think it's all been co-opted and lost, the ethos, or have we gone too far?
Right. So another kind of interesting slogan from the 70s, there was a feminist writer, thinker, Jo Freeman, who wrote a pamphlet called The Tyranny of Structurelessness. And I think she was basically talking about how the focus on having unstructured organizations and kind of utopian groups often meant that power dynamics were concealed. And so I bring that up in terms of a co-op because I think one of the biggest things that allowed some activist businesses to survive over decades was clear structure and clear lines of authority. That doesn't mean there wasn't an effort to make things democratic and to make them more just, but that it wasn't, you know, a denial of the fact that there need to be certain people who are in management. There need to be certain people who are accountable for certain decisions instead of just being able to say the whole group decided something. And so that structure is important. And I think a lot of co-ops have found that that's one of the most important things to keep them alive over the years.
Very briefly, Josh, has that movement disintegrated or has it found its way? Was it the parent of something we can see today?
It's kind of a dual legacy that these businesses have. On the one hand, you've got co-ops popping up in places like Durham or all over the country, new worker-owned companies. You've got a new wave of, I think, activist-influenced businesses. On the other hand, the businesses that I looked at in the 70s kind of created a language of liberation and social change through business that a lot of major corporations today have latched onto and I would say even co-opted, especially companies that are in Silicon Valley, for example. The whole talk of mindful meditation and offices without walls and mm-hmm. flat org charts and that kind of thing. And just there are a lot of very meaningful, intentional social enterprises today, but there are also some that just kind of latch onto the idea of social enterprise as a way to maybe justify what they're doing in a way that's not true to the political roots of
Joshua
activist business.
Joshua Clark Davis, a history professor at the University of Baltimore, author of From Head Shops to Whole Foods, The Rise and Fall of Activist Entrepreneurs. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
I want to say one more time, I am on the board of directors of DCM, so the Durham Co-op Market, and I'm Frank Stacio on the State of Things.